Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying, multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which have sadly included pregnancy loss, I am finally pregnant. Hi there, how are you doing? Kat here. Welcome to episode 2 of the Finally Pregnant podcast. Thank you so, so much for everyone who listened to the trailer and the first episode and everyone who has got in contact with me and told me how much they've loved it and resonated with it. It's just incredible to hear. You never know if you're hitting the right note. And so the fact that I am, and I have so far anyway, at least, is just amazing to hear. So thank you so, so much. And to everyone who shared it, it's just incredible. The more people that can access this kind of support and this kind of camaraderie, really, you know, so that, as someone said, it's nice not to feel weird on your own, you know, or have the weird thoughts, perhaps, you know, it's not weird. We're all thinking it. So we're talking about it, which is amazing. Today, we're going to be talking to Mel Brown, who is an incredible nutritionist. And as we hand over to the interview, I will do a proper introduction of her there. I'll be honest, my food has kind of come and gone throughout my pregnancy. There's been good days and there's been bad days. I had this conversation with Mel at a time that I really needed it, actually, because I kept saying to my husband, I need to eat more vegetables. I know I should be eating more vegetables. And I just didn't fancy them. But after this, I did, you know, improve what I ate, which was really good. So hopefully, if you're having one of those moments, this will help you too. What else do I need to say at this point? Because it's quite a long interview, so I'm not going to talk for long now. I am going to ask you to subscribe if you haven't already. So subscribe to this podcast. If you can rate and review it, that would be incredible because that all helps. And yeah, share it, basically. That would be amazing. The more people that share it, the more people that it can reach, the better. My clinic even shared it, which is great. So, you know, contact your clinic and ask them to share it, because all I keep hearing is there isn't anything like this out there for people. So let's make sure that now that it is, you know, that it's getting to people. That's it for now. I just wanted to say hello, say thank you from the bottom of my heart. And yeah, I hope you enjoy the interview. Take care. My guest today is the wonderful Mel Brown, who is a fabulous nutritionist who I've come across several times actually now. Mel has been practicing since 2002 and she focuses specifically on fertility, IVF and pregnancy. She has written for countless magazines and newspapers, including the Sunday Telegraph, Harper's Bazaar, Elle. Her knowledge is vast. And one of the things that I love when I read Mel's website, which really came over the first time that I ever met her, was that it says, above all, I am not a hardcore killjoy. I like my wine, chocolate, roast potatoes and croissants. You know, it's like, that's what you want from a nutritionist. So Mel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Kat. You're very welcome.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm laughing at that roast potatoes and thing. Yeah, I'd be a total hypocrite if I made my clients go hardcore when I like my treats.
Exactly, and that's what you want. I remember when I first heard you speak at an event, and it was about organic goods, and what you said, which was really realistic, was that you don't have to go out and just chuck everything out from your kind of from your bathroom. Just replace as you're going along. And you know, for someone who has spent considerable amounts of money on IVF treatment, I haven't got the money to go replace everything in one go. So it was just a really gentle, realistic way of kind of addressing it without me feeling guilty. So, and I really love that about your whole approach, which is fantastic, and hence why I've asked you here today. A slightly different tack this time, so not the fertility side of things, but still very much part of the fertility journey, I'm realizing. And that is, when you get pregnant, like when you get those two lines after you've tried so hard, whether you have been through kind of years of trying naturally, whether you've had, you know, kind of ovulation stimulation,
IVF, whatever the way that you've got here, you've got those two lines. And there's so much that comes with that, which is what this whole podcast is addressing. And some of it can be medication specific, which is where we'll start, I think. But then there's also other information, which is just really valuable as you go through your pregnancy. So going to the specific IVF information, I remember when I first was pregnant this time, and I was told by a nutritionist that I was randomly in contact with, but, you know, I kind of am in contact with lots of different people, that I should be taking omega-3, but it is a blood thinner, kind of, it can work as a blood thinner. So I shouldn't take it until I'd stop taking my Clexane or Fragmin or whatever blood thinner I was on, which I had never heard of before. So can you talk us through that and perhaps any other IVF specific information that we might not be aware of?
Yes, of course. And it becomes very much more complicated when you're taking a lot of IVF medication. You've got your progesterone, you've possibly got immune drugs, steroids, all sorts of things people are taking, which there can be potential side effects of, and possible interactions with vitamins and things like that. But talking specifically about the omega-3, the omega-3 for pregnancy is called DHA, and DHA has less of a blood thinning ability than EPA, which is generally the one that people take before they get pregnant and while they're kind of preparing for IVF and things like that. And actually, it has a very, very, very slight blood thinning effect. But and so normally, I will get people to start taking that in the second trimester. Or sometimes I often keep them on for the first trimester because it doesn't have a hugely significant blood thinning effect in comparison to the Clexane and the other blood thinners that people are taking. If it did, then it would be an ideal replacement for Clexane, to be perfectly honest. It has much fewer side effects than Clexane. So I tend to think, well, look, if you're just taking a little bit of DHA, so whatever might be with Pregnacare, they have their omega-3, or the one that I recommend, which is called Bump and Glory, that's not particularly spectacularly high dose. They're both the recommended doses for pregnancy. If you want to be extra, extra careful, then don't take it in the first trimester because it's not so valuable in the first trimester, but it becomes very valuable in the second and especially in the third trimester. So even if people are on Clexane to 38 weeks, I will usually say, look, take it, you know, maybe if you feel a bit unsure, take it every other day. But I think personally, the benefits of DHA outweigh its disadvantages, if there really are any significant disadvantages in terms of blood thinning, which I think, as I said, it's because it's got a very low level of blood thinning. I mean, you know, there are lots of things that one eats in one's diet, garlic, ginger, that also have a blood thinning effect, you know, and you're not necessarily told to not take them when you're on Clexane. And also, if you eat your greens, Kat, which is my mantra, eat your greens. If you eat your greens, you get vitamin K, which is a blood clotting vitamin, which counterbalances very nicely any kind of over blood thinning that might occur.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So that answers your question. I feel I made that very complicated.
No. I think what I took from that was that, you know, it is a thing, but it's not, you know, the benefits outweigh the negatives. But if you want to be extra cautious, you know, you can hold off initially, but yes, counteract it, eat your greens.
Yeah, I mean, it's like eating oily fish, you know, basically, you know, if you eat a couple of portions of oily fish or maybe three portions of oily fish, which after all, in the old days we did, you know, you're not told not to eat oily fish now. I mean, you're told to keep it, to limit it, but that's for other reasons. I think people should be reassured that they're not, you know, doubling the blood thinning, capabilities of their drugs, you know, by taking something like DHA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's good to know. And I am I use Bare Biology as well, actually, which is great. And I've also heard kind of taking it into fourth trimester, if you decide to breastfeed, that it's good to continue taking that into, in, you know, while you're breastfeeding as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's an absolute necessity. It's very much part of postnatal. And to be honest, Kat, even if you're not breastfeeding, because there is lots of research showing that DHA helps to sort of mitigate any postnatal depression. So this is such an important brain omega-3 fatty acid, and very low levels of postnatal depression can be associated with very low levels of these omega-3 fats. And of course, the baby will take everything from kind of parasitic in the sense that they, you know, all your DHA, whatever you consume, the baby will take it, or rather the placenta will take it, actually. That's the top of the food chain, actually, in pregnancy, is the placenta. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't supplement and then you breastfeed on top, you're in danger of really running low on your omega-3, and that can risk, you know, baby blues, postnatal depression. So if I have any clients who've got any kind of history of depression or have had postnatal depression before, I will usually make sure they're on a very good dose of omega-3, whether they breastfeed or not, after the birth.
Good to know. And I do have, I'll hands up now, a slight obsession with the fact that, and I think it's only minor, and I am actually doing another episode on this, there has been some links, limited, but some links between fertility, pregnancies and postnatal depression. And so, you know, I'm really conscious of that, and to the point where I'm almost preparing, you know, for that to happen, even though it, you know, not everyone gets postnatal depression, so it's not something that everyone needs to worry about. But it's really great to hear that. And I've specifically heard, and we will move on from this because otherwise I'll talk about this all the time, about the baby blues, particularly on kind of day 3 or 4. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. When the milk comes in, actually.
Okay, is there anything specifically other than omega-3 at that point and the DHA that we could take, or you know, is the work being done already by taking that?
Well, it's very kind of new, and, you know, to recommend things specifically for conditions, particularly like postnatal depression, unless you're almost following NICE guidelines, you know, government guidelines, is kind of stepping into slightly dodgy ground. But there is a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus, and that has been shown to have very positive effects on lots of things in pregnancy, from allergy prevention in babies, you know, so babies seem to be very allergic nowadays, you know, that's the kind of thing my grandmother would have said, oh, babies nowadays, they're very allergic, you know, eczema being, you know, kind of a big one. So rhamnosus seems to mitigate against that, but there is some suggestion that rhamnosus also can help, and I use the word mitigate because prevent or help, it's not proven, none of this is proven, but that also may mitigate against postnatal depression, this probiotic. And this is to do with what's called the gut-brain axis. Probiotics can have a very specific effect on brain function, particularly depression. So there's a lot of work going on into this probiotic.
Okay.
Buy over the counter.
Okay. Good to know. And I'll put that in the show notes as well, so that everyone can kind of link to that. So moving on from that, what about other supplements we should be taking, you know, the folic acid versus folate, etc.?
Oh, yes, that's a very long-running debate. Personally, I'm a fan of folate rather than folic acid. Folic acid is the synthetic version of folate, and folate is just it's more easily absorbed by the body, and it's more easily metabolized and excreted. And I know there's a big debate about tongue tie and folic acid, which I don't think there's any kind of proof that tongue tie is caused by folic acid, but certainly I always recommend my own clients to take folate, because the thing with folic acid seems to be, if it's not metabolized properly and you have levels of unmetabolized folic acid kind of floating around your body, that might be the thing linked with tongue tie. But as I said, there is no proper evidence linking it, really. So you know, I think probably the amount in a multivitamin, a pregnancy multivitamin, which is 400 micrograms of folic acid, is fine to continue taking. I mean, it's a bit difficult. I have to sit on the fence with this cat a bit because, you know, you can't say to people, no, don't take folic acid, because then you get people kind of not taking folic acid. And then, of course, there's that. But there are lots of supplements around now that use folate instead of folic acid on the same dose. And those are the ones that I personally tend to recommend. And certainly folate, folic acid, whatever it is essential in the first trimester of pregnancy, because at 8 weeks, the neural tube closes and folic acid, folate, helps that process to occur. And if you don't take it, then you can risk neural tube defects, what they call neural tube defects. But after the first trimester, strictly speaking, you don't really have to take anything. You know, and that's certainly NHS guidelines and midwives. They often say the only thing you need in pregnancy is folic acid and vitamin D, but then nobody's very specific about when, you know, how much and when do you stop and all that kind of thing. So it's all a bit vague. I double up the folate if they've had previous history of miscarriage, but take them off it at 14 weeks. So second trimester, and just keep people on a general, not very high dose multivitamin for the rest of the pregnancy. And that's partly because people's eating habits do go, sadly, very awry in pregnancy, you know. And at least if you're taking your multivitamin, you know that you've got all your nutrients. You can, you know, if you all you want to eat, like I know you mentioned, Kat, that, you know, you wanted to eat pasta, and everybody, that I tell you, the favorite food in early pregnancy is a cheese sandwich.
Yes,
that's it.
Yes.
And white bread, actually, as white as you could possibly get it, is the favorite thing. So taking your multivitamin in the first trimester when you're feeling sick and you've got food cravings and aversions and things like that just covers you for, you know, the healthy diet that you're supposed to be eating, and then possibly you're not. But in the second trimester, you know, you start feeling better. You've got to sort of get back on the good path again. That's a tricky one, because often people have got into habits of not eating vegetables and, you know, just eating beige food. And even though they don't feel nauseous anymore, they kind of forget that they should be eating healthily, and they still eat beige food all the time. So, you know, keeping with the multivitamin just means that you get the nutrients that you'd be getting from an otherwise healthy diet. Have I answered your question?
Absolutely. Like just yes. To put our minds at rest. So I'm in my third trimester, and I've been taking a pregnancy supplement. It is a plant-based one. It's Wild Nutrition. You know, and the omega-3 I've been taking since about 12 weeks or so. And definitely, absolutely, like what you were saying there about the yellow food, I went through that, and my husband, he said to me, oh my gosh, I can tell that you're pregnant, because our larder, like kind of the bread compartment in there, was full. Now, I'm not a big fan of sandwiches. I'll eat a baguette every now and again. I'll have a bit of toast at the weekend, but I don't really eat naturally. I don't eat a lot of bread. I was hot cross buns, crumpets, like I said, you know, and then the pasta, and it was just, I couldn't eat anything but this beige or yellow food. And you do feel guilty because you think, gosh, I should be eating loads of nutrients and loads of greens, but, you know, but you just can't stomach it.
I mean, I remember that very well. I love my greens. The things that people most commonly go off are the broccoli kind of vegetables, which contain sulfur. Now, funny enough, partly the nausea and the going off foods, it's called the fetal protection hypothesis. And this is the hypothesis that pregnant women, they pick up sort of a sense of food poisoning much more acutely than the rest of us do. So, for example, things like broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, those kind of vegetables, they contain sulfur. Now, the rest of us, unless we overcook, you know, overcooked waterlogged Brussels sprouts are like sulfur, but, you know, your nice steamed tender stem broccoli, I never think of sulfur. Sulfur is the smell of rotten, it's rotten eggs. And so pregnant women have this very acute protective mechanism that protects them from food poisoning. I mean, obviously it's very basic, but that that's why they just want to eat. So the other thing they go off is eggs and fish, which of course are really important in pregnancy. So, but that's because it's a natural thing in the brain going, stay away from those things. They might poison us, you know. And so if we just eat bread and beige things, we're not going to get poisoned. So, you know, it's quite a natural thing and certainly something that people shouldn't feel guilty about.
That's so interesting because broccoli is one of the things. There's two things that I've gone off and broccoli is one of them. And just the thought of it, I can't even get the thought past kind of my gullet, you know, kind of in my throat. And the other thing is mushrooms. I love mushrooms more than broccoli usually. But I can't, the idea of mushrooms, I can't even stomach that either. But that's really, I didn't know the science behind that and why that is the case. That's so interesting. Because there are a lot of things we're not supposed to eat, aren't there? But
well, there are indeed, yes.
And how, you know, like I don't want to say to everyone, it's fine, don't worry, just be careful. But just in case someone did eat something that is on a kind of don't eat when you're pregnant list, a lot of it is precautionary, is that right? And if it's actually cooked, so we're talking here about blue cheese, shellfish, although I think that's one that I would avoid with as much as possible. But if it's only a precaution that something might be wrong with it, and generally if it is cooked like properly and or frozen previously, that, you know, hopefully there won't be an issue. You know, don't panic if you've done something like that. Would that be correct to say?
I would definitely say that. And, you know, if you're not having any symptoms, then you haven't got anything. So, you know, often people will eat soft cheese or something, you know, maybe some, I don't know, it's unusual to eat something like brie, actually, when you're trying to, because everybody knows about that. But, you know, sometimes they will. But these specific infections that directly affect the fetus produce symptoms, you know, you feel ill. So it's not like you don't know that you've got it. So I guess I am slightly on the neurotic side with food poisoning because I myself got very bad food poisoning in pregnancy. I was really, really sick, actually. And this was caused by, I mean, to be honest, the human hand cat is a dangerous thing when it's coming into contact with your food, you know, and this particular thing was caused by probably some level of fecal contamination on a sandwich that somebody I'd had from a sandwich shop. So I usually kind of, I'm quite fanatical about, you know, making sure that you don't have, you know, if you go in and have anything made for you or prepared, even a juice, actually, I was horrified going into a juice shop and at the lack of hygiene in making my green juice, actually. I won't mention the shop, obviously, but I was pretty appalled, you know, bare hands, no gloves. I didn't even know whether the fruit and vegetables had been washed. I didn't know whether the juicer was clean. You know, he was taking the money from the person in front of me. And I was thinking, Jesus Christ, you know, this is you know, there are many stages along this process where I could get food poisoning from this juice, you know. I do go on about it quite strictly to my clients. But yes, you're absolutely right. So long as something is cooked, properly cooked, then you're going to be all right. I mean, funnily enough, we're coming up to one of the worst times for food poisoning is the Great British Barbecue season. So barbecues, my friend used to work in A&E, and she said in the summer on Sundays, it was an absolute nightmare because as well as having all the drunk people, you got all the people who are poisoned at barbecues. So that's really when I do sort of say to people, look, just be really careful at barbecues because, you know, you get the tongs that have picked up the raw chicken, you know, being hauling out the tossing the salad, you know, and that's a very easy place to get quite bad food poisoning. But, you know, I think just caution. And I have a list when I see my clients, you know, I give them a list of things that I personally regard as being slightly dodgy, as well as the list from the Food Standards Agency as well. And I just, you know, do advise, just caution. Yeah, just be careful. But, you know, you can't be totally neurotic about it. You know, food poisoning is pretty rare. Yes. You know, in pregnancy that causes a problem, it's quite rare. Listeria poisoning is actually, it's quite rare. You know, raw meat. Yeah, I have had a few people who've had toxoplasmosis, which is the other thing that you don't want to be getting when you're pregnant. But, you know, and it's very tempting, you know, because you often feel like having, you know, I remember really wanting a steak when I was about probably 28 weeks pregnant or something, you know, you want that iron and you just have that craving like, oh, I need to eat a steak now. And of course, you know, a little dry, leathery piece of meat just doesn't really do it. And so it's easy to think, oh, it doesn't matter if it's just a teeny bit pink in the middle, but it does matter. It does matter. So people have to be a bit wary about those specific things.
Yes. And you know, we're very lucky these days in some ways or in many ways, but because we have our phones. And I know that I have countless times been in a supermarket or a restaurant and Googled, can I eat something? The only issue with that is there's so much information out there and you see it on blogs, you see it on websites, you see it on the NHS, but this Food Standards Authority, was it that you just said then? That's the kind of...
Yes, they have a... It's quite a basic list and, you know, it kind of, it's almost like a list from, you know, 20 years ago, you know, it doesn't really encompass, you know, the wide variety of different nationality food that we all eat now. It's a bit sort of English kind of list, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, your main point that you made at the beginning about making sure that things are, you know, I would say out of all of that, it's making sure that things are cooked properly and that if they're not cooked, then you know about the food hygiene, you know that you're not having all over your food. Yeah. So you know, say you want a sandwich when you're out, for example, you know, I would say probably go to Pret. I mean, even though I know Pret's, you know, slightly, you know, with the allergy thing, but, you know, by and large, you know, that's a company that they make their food fresh every day. They've got very strict hygiene rules, you know. Which they are bound by, you know, it's a big company. So at the end of the day, whatever one thinks about fast food, I would personally go and get my sandwich from Pret rather than go and get it from somebody who made it by hand if I was pregnant, having had my experience.
Okay. Yeah. And that did happen to you, but everything was fine in the long run.
Yes, yes. Babies are remarkably resilient, you know. It was just me. I felt awful, but she was fine.
It is possible to get through. I was just thinking then, so we've got the Food Standards Agency, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. I'm totally having what they call baby brain and I've lost what I was going to ask you. It will come back to me. Let's talk about some other things. So cravings. So my craving personally, you know, I don't think that everyone gets cravings necessarily. I think that people, and you know, you hear all the ones about charcoal and, you know, kind of like the old wives' tales.
Oh yeah, the weird things.
Yes. Mine has been sugar. And again, because of, you know, 6 years of trying to conceive, I've turned organic for the most part. I've been doing everything that I can, so I didn't eat a lot of sugar. I have been a sugar fiend, and even now, like, I have to have, well, not every day I would say, but there's a point in most days where I'm like, I need a Fanta or an orange and lemonade. So that is my, and I definitely eat more chocolate than I had eaten before. Right at the beginning it was Tamfastics, which I had to downgrade just to a normal Haribo sweet because I was like, there is so much sugar in a Tamfastic. if anything, I suppose my craving has been sugar, but you don't necessarily get cravings, do you? It's not like, that's not something to worry about if you don't get cravings.
Oh, no, it's nothing to worry about. No, not at all. You know, I always ask my clients, you know, have you got any cravings or aversions, you know, because, you know, broccoli is a common aversion, as I said. And often the cravings will be similar to what you said, you know, pasta, beige food. That's all I want. You know, I just want a baked potato. I don't want anything on it, maybe some cheese, but that's it. So sort of commoner cravings might be more acidic things. So people want to eat, you know, that's probably partly where your fizzy drink kind of desire. They want to eat sharp, sharp, clean tastes as well. So crispy green apple, funnily enough, crispy green apples are quite a common. Grapefruit juice. Now, I do always advise my clients who are on any medication not to have grapefruit juice because it's not very good when you're taking any meds. But, you know, it's those kind of acidy foods, salt and vinegar crisps. That is a really common one. It might be the vinegar, it's the saltiness, you know. Actually, you're quite unusual to get sweet cravings. I find that most people have savoury cravings.
Ah, that's interesting.
But no, your cravings are your cravings. It's just to be aware, you know, say you get strong sugar cravings. It's quite a good idea to think, well, why am I getting this really strong, overwhelming sugar craving? Is it because I didn't eat enough for lunch? Maybe I skipped lunch. Maybe I didn't eat enough protein. Maybe I just had a bowl of pasta for lunch, which will trigger another sugar craving because pasta is such a strong carbohydrate that you will probably get a sugar low, and then you want to have your sugar, and then you have another, you know, you put in the sugar, and then, you know, a few hours later you'll have another sugar low because of that. So it's just to look at, you know, look at how you construct your actual meals. Are they good quality? You know, are you eating enough at lunchtime and enough good solid, you know, protein type foods to keep your blood sugar level steady, really?
Yeah.
But, you know, as you said, these are quite common, and you know, you get tired. I mean, Kat, you know you've made another practically fully grown human being that you're lugging around, you know, so these things are not unusual, you know, that you feel like you need a bit of an energy boost.
Yeah, and I have to, you know, hands up, I'm not a foodie. You know, food doesn't really interest me. I would have beans on toast every night. Can I cook? Yes, if I want to, but it's not my bag necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, my husband loves food and he does the majority of the cooking in our house, although just due to circumstance at the moment, that's not necessarily the case. But yeah, I do struggle. Like, hands up, I'm probably not the healthiest. I probably don't eat as many vegetables as I should, you know, and especially at the moment because I can be quite, I don't want, picky about food. It's more that I just don't ever know what I fancy, and being pregnant, that has really perpetuated that, you know, because there are days where I just couldn't eat something and the next day I would be able to eat it, but it's made me quite fussy, I would say, on what I can eat, and I almost have to shop every day or every couple of days rather than plan a whole week of food, because I literally from one day to the next I'm not sure what I'm going to be able to eat.
Yes, pregnant women are very capricious like that. You know, their partners will think, oh, thank God, she really likes that, right, I'll stock up on it, and then 2 days later you're like, oh, I can't eat that now, I don't like it, you know, and it's just the way of the condition. But one of the things, just going back to vegetables, for example, Kat, is there is some good evidence suggesting that women who eat vegetables have children who will eat vegetables. So if for no other reason, eat your broccoli, because the research on, this is on animal research, unfortunately, but it has shown that the compounds in broccoli are found in the amniotic fluid. So the fetus, I mean, in this case, it was rats, they are much more amenable to eating those compounds in their food if they've been exposed to them in pregnancy. And trust me, Kat, you want your child to eat vegetables. Yes. So there is a lot of evidence showing that what a woman eats in pregnancy very strongly, the tastes of the baby, so the wider the variety of foods that you can expose the baby to, the more amenable he or she will be to having a more varied diet. And unfortunately, that does apply to sugar. So if you eat a lot of sugar in pregnancy, and I'm not saying that you do in any way, but if you eat a lot of sugar in pregnancy, you definitely lay down the sort of groundwork for a child that's never got its head out of the sweet drawer, basically, and you're always watching its weight. You know, it will have a sweet tooth. So just kind of bear that in mind.
Yeah, that is motivation enough. And I have heard that before, that, yeah, the flavours go through. I think, is it towards the end of the second trimester, third trimester, that definitely starts to happening. So that, yeah, that's my motivation.
Yes. So, you know, just lightly cooked, you know, something like tender stem broccoli, you know, maybe cut it, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of, you know, salt and pepper, something like that. Just remember, you're almost feeding the baby broccoli, as well as obviously it's good for you. But now is the time that you're thinking, crikey, you know, if I want my baby to eat these kind of foods, I need to start eating them myself. And so long as you're not gagging over the food, I often say to my clients, look, if you know you can get it down, you don't have to like it. It's not about liking it. But if you can get it down, get it down. You don't have to love it, but just get it down.
Yeah, definitely. Good advice. Green beans. That's been my go-to vegetable. So I know I've been eating vegetables, but I've eaten a lot of them because that seems to be fine. But I will. Yeah, I need to vary it a bit.
Sulfur-containing vegetables. It's the broccoli and the cabbage and the kale and the sprouts. It's those vegetables, because it's the sulfur compounds, which we were talking about before, that little children don't like. They like them. They're a bit like pregnant women in that they're kind of sensitive to, they don't like, they can taste it. And so it's those cruciferous vegetables like broccoli that you need to get the baby exposed to now.
Okay, that's my promise. And definitely kale, and I love kale, so that's top of the shopping list now, I have to say. And it's come back to me what I mentioned, or what I forgot earlier on. You mentioned earlier about the different things that people might eat, the grapefruit juice, even the apples to a degree. And for me, I've eaten a lot of mango, which I love normally, but that has been a go-to.
I mean, it's got lots of nutrients in it. It's very rich in minerals, you know, which gives it that kind of funny taste, that iron taste that it has. It is colossally high in sugar. So just maybe mixing a little bit of mango with some other more low sugar fruit like berries and things like that. So you've still got a bit of mango taste, but you're not eating a whole mango a day, Kat.
Right. Good to know. But with that, and some of the other things that you'd mentioned earlier on, I'm now suffering from heartburn. It comes and goes, you know, but I do have a Gaviscon in my bag. Is there anything that you can do to help counteract that naturally rather than taking any medication for it?
Well, not eating too much in one go. I mean, often people just, you know, maybe if you're very hungry, you might kind of shovel your food down a bit fast. So eating slowly, chewing your food so that you're not getting this sudden rush of sort of half-chewed food into the stomach. Eating little and often. I mean, in real life, I am not a fan of snacking, and all my clients know that I try and get them off eating between meals. But I think in pregnancy, it's the only time that probably that's the best way to eat, is small meals more regularly. And certainly with the evening meal, don't overload your gut with food in the evening. And, you know, it's just a question of sleeping with your head elevated on a pillow so that the gut, you know, the hydrochloric acid, basically, that causes the acid reflux, isn't able to, with gravity, rise up through your throat. But I think it is just the weakening. It's the progesterone that weakens, or rather relaxes, smooth muscle. So progesterone is relaxing all your, you know, your uterine muscle to stop you from going into premature labour, but it relaxes everything. So that's why people get constipated, and of course the oesophagus also relax, which just allows the baby's, of course, pushing upwards as well. So you've got a double whammy. It's actually, you know, forcing the contents of the stomach slightly upwards. And so you've got this kind of situation of acid reflux, basically. But I think taking Gaviscon is fine. It's perfectly, I mean, of it. But, you know, I think often there's nothing much you can do about it, really.
So thank you so much for that. There are lots of other things that we could talk about. And one of the things that I actually, funny enough, it came up last night on Instagram. Fortunately, touch wood at this point is not something I've suffered from, but I do know that it is quite common. And that is constipation during pregnancy.
Oh, yes. Constipation. Oh, yes. It is really common. And again, for the reasons that I've just discussed about the acid reflex, reflux, you know, you've got that weight pressing down on the bowel, you've got the hormones that are keeping everything from contracting. And obviously, you don't want to be taking lots of laxatives in pregnancy, you know, that kind of can give you the runs and things like that. So it's just eating, you know, making sure that you have enough fiber. So often I just recommend psyllium husks, actually. There's a product called Lepicol, or Holland and Barrett do a similar one called Regucol. And that's just psyllium husks with some digestive enzymes and things. And you just put a couple of teaspoons in water, and you just make sure that you drink lots of water and have it during the day. At some stage, it doesn't really matter when you have it. But that can actually really help. Sometimes a little magnesium before bed can help, you know, just a little bit. Making sure you drink plenty of water. Often pregnant people don't want to drink lots of water for some reason, you know, maybe because you just feel full and, you know, maybe the thirst reflex isn't so good, but certainly drinking lots of water, eating your broccoli, Kat, you know, broccoli stalks. And yeah, I mean, you know, it is important, though, not to get constipated, because obviously you've got the risk of piles of hemorrhoids then. So I would definitely say that the Lepicol, Regucol, psyllium husks and water, and, you know, whole grains and things like that, but plenty of water, tends to sort of work reasonably well. I mean, there are other things that you can take sort of along the more natural route, but, you know, I probably shouldn't sort of go into those at this particular stage, but maybe I'll do a a constipation Instagram or something like that.
Good plan, good plan. And I'll put, again, I'll put links to those things that you've mentioned in the show notes as well, so people can have a look at those.
And
that's brilliant. And is there anything else, you know, that you regularly come across with clients that is a myth or something that like would be your number one recommendation, which you might already have touched upon, but just to end, kind of what would be your top tip?
I think I've got sort of several, but I think probably my main one, particularly with what we discussed about pregnancy from fertility treatment, where, you know, you start the pregnancy in a heightened state of anxiety because you almost think somebody's going to jump out from behind a hedge and go, joke, you know, you thought you were pregnant, but you're not, you know. You feel so insecure about it, you know. I remember that after a couple of miscarriages, you're just anxious all the time. And I think obviously as the pregnancy progresses, you become less anxious, you know, you're kind of, it's almost like a waiting game cat, isn't it? You go from one scan to another and you breathe a sigh of relief. And then you think, right, I've done the 12-week scan. So, oh my God, now I've got to wait for the, you know, 20-week scan and, you know, perhaps everything won't be all right then. You know, I mean, it's a very stressful time when you've had, you know, infertility experience or miscarriage. But I think one of the things that I really try and highlight, and you're at that stage of pregnancy where I think you've got to, you'll have to do this, is get your rest. I am amazed at how people persevere through very long working days. You know, I always say to my clients, get a cleaning lady. If you don't have a cleaning lady, and I know that sounds like a very middle class thing to say, do get your cleaning lady. But I can't tell you how many clients are doing the bloody cleaning at the weekend. You know, they're going to work all week and getting home at 8 o'clock at night and getting up at, you know, 6:30 in the morning. And then they're doing their cleaning at the weekend. And you have to respect the fact that you are making another human being. You have to rest and take it easy wherever you can, particularly at your stage of pregnancy, because honestly, Kat, you know, this will be the last time you can do it, you know, to be honest, until they're about 15. Don't think, oh, I'm just pregnant, I'm not ill, you know, I don't have to, you know, I mustn't be so overindulgent of myself, you know. You have to look after yourself. You have to make conscious efforts to eat properly, to get your sleep, to go for a walk, to get outside in the sun, to just take care of yourself. The same you take care of your child when it comes along, you know. And often the mum-to-be and the mum puts themselves at the bottom of the list, you know, and it starts in pregnancy. And so just thinking about how you can take care of yourself better is probably my number one tip.
That's fabulous advice. It really is, because I've noticed that I am more tired just now that I'm in the third trimester. I don't have a long commute or anything like that. I'm really lucky. I do wonder how people do it. They must literally get home and go straight to bed. But the cleaning thing, you know, like I did talk about this on my Instagram, and I will no doubt talk about it again. And interestingly, Emma Cannon had done something similar she had done a post about surrender on the day that I did actually surrender, and I asked for help. And I'm fortunate to have my mum, and she's very local to me, you know, and I just said, please, can you come and help me clean my house, because I was desperate. Yeah. It's so funny that, and she's coming up later today to help me clean my house again, you know, just to stay on top of it.
Yeah, because it can get overwhelming, and also it's physically quite demanding. And you know, you know that you're feeling more tired now, but you know, part of the time I bet you still just ignore it and don't kind of, you know, because one just gets on with one's life. But in the old days and in different cultures, you know, people had their mums, their sisters, aunts, grandmothers, you know, looking after them. You know, it's hard now. I think it's quite hard for modern women to, you know, you're literally really being everything to everybody, you know, and doing everything. And sometimes you just have got to take a big deep breath and a step back and think, oh, hang on a minute, how can I take care of myself a little bit better?
Definitely. And that is food and rest.
It's food and rest, exactly.
Yeah, brilliant.
You put it better myself, Kat.
yes, I did it. Thank you so much, Mel. Honestly, that is invaluable. And I know that I'm certainly going to rewrite my shopping list, should I say, and make an extra effort to get those greens down me and as just as much as possible. We are having a barbecue this weekend. I'm going to be extra careful about all of that. Although I have, my husband can be very, very cautious about that anyway. So, and we've got vegetarians coming, so we use lots of different kind of utensils, etc. So you've given me lots of, pardon the pun, but food for thought. So I really appreciate that. I know that lots of other people listening will be able to kind of take so much from it. So thank you so, so much, Mel. And I'll put your details in the show notes as well. So people can come and follow you on Instagram or head over to your website and get in contact if they do want a one-to-one consultation at any point of fertility or IVF or within their pregnancy as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Super. Thank you so much, Mel. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for doing things like this. I think it's just so valuable, and I'm so full of admiration for, you know, people like you that raise this kind of awareness and give people so much information. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you so much. All right, then. You take care now.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.